feature Biz Lang,
Dracula Grill,
Robert Lehman and Toby Ramaswamy,
Shagasimi Ilvasakar,
Starflower,
and Trust.
Performances will be accompanied by live analog-based visuals by Shane Donahue.
It's an immersive, one-of-a-kind audio-visual experience.
More information about Noise Party Volume 14 is available at thecedar.org.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org, non-commercial, community-powered radio. Well, Thursday at this time, it's the Northern Sun Radio News with Don Olson, Dave Gudnick, and we have a studio full of people who we're going to talk about Cuba today. And I think you know why. if you listen to these, anything going on in the news. Dave, do you want to kick it off?
Yeah, thanks, Don. And I'm just going to take 2 or 3 minutes here, and then we'll hear from our friends about Cuba. And but I want to provide some context. You know, we here in the United States have a very long imperial history, and yet I still occasionally have arguments with people who don't even recognize the U.S. as an empire. Now, we've had very articulate guests on this show about U.S. as an empire in decline, and yet this still, of course, is not the recognition you get in the mainstream media, and we're going to hear some more detail about that type of propaganda to which we're subjected every day, every year in regard to Cuba, we'll hear, but there's a lot more background. You know, we've actually been, since our European origins, an imperial power on the continent, and a global empire since at least 1898, again with reference to Cuba. And the financial power of the U.S. was supreme after 1945, adding to, equal to or greater than its dozens of military interventions. And I do mean dozens and dozens, many of them unknown. Historian Alpha McCoy in Shadows of the 20th Century documented 80 under Eisenhower alone, 80 covert interventions under Eisenhower alone, who has a rather benign image. So denying U.S. imperial behavior is very widespread, and one version this takes is our defeats are called mistakes. These mistakes, despite good intentions. So this is, again, obfuscating what our real history is. Our intentions are supposedly benevolent, democratic, and support the rule of law. Then our adversaries, populist nationalist revolutions, become adversaries and communists, and then go on to call them terrorists and autocratic and what have you. And we don't tolerate these things because they interfere with our power extension, which is both economic and other, financial in particular, as I mentioned. So look at these examples. 1949, Chinese Communist Revolution. We didn't even recognize it till the 1970s, and we opposed it, tried to subvert it. 1959 in Cuba, 1979 in Iran, 1999 in Venezuela. All of these are subject to sanctions, subversion, and attack. So this is the pattern, and I want to get people to recognize it's not just one place or another. It's a longstanding historical pattern. And we can hope that some of our guests are correct in analyzing this as an empire in decline. Now let's hear from friends in the Minnesota Cuba Committee and the Solidarity Committee on the Americas, Jackie Picorni, Rebecca Pera, and Greg Clavey. Take it away. Thanks.
Hello, listeners of Northern Sun News. Thank you for tuning in today. We have some important information. Especially, we would like to make sure that people are writing down some asks that we have of you. One is a public response. We have a network, and we'd like you to chime in on it on Facebook or Instagram to the various committees that are represented here today, and look for our actions that are happening and our events that are happening so that we can give some public response that we're not going to allow this in our name. And that's one of our responses, our asks that we have today, and to not only show up at our events, but call your senators and representatives and demand that they take action. Calling this to the floor for a vote on the War Powers Act, calling for normalization. Minnesota does not want this policy. We want normalization. We want trade. We have definitely, Minnesota has set up relationships in the medical community, in the governance community, in the agricultural community, in the scientific community, academic community, on and on, that benefit Minnesotans from our relationship with Cuba. We need to defend that, and we need to, as David said, start realizing that what our government represents is not in our interests. It's not even our government. It's the government of the rich.
Right on.
And thank you, Greg. I would also like to mention that our second ask of listeners of Northern Sun News and other friends is for actual material aid, donations for material aid to Cuba. As we know, the Trump and Rubio's recent oil blockade on Cuba has doubled the infant mortality right now in Cuba. So that is now on par with the United States, whereas previously throughout the past six decades since 1959 in the revolution, it was one of the best in the world. So we are asking listeners to donate to Global Health Partners. They have a campaign through Saving Lives, and it is specifically for neonatal care for infants and mothers in Cuba right now who are the most at risk due to the oil blockade.
That was Rebecca Pera, and this is Jackie Picorni. Our third ask, and we also want to, is about travel to Cuba. And along with that, we want to also promote that the three of us will be speaking again this coming Sunday at May Day Books at 2 p.m. If you want to learn more, we'll go more extensively into our recent trips. All three of us were just there in Cuba for the May Day celebrations and solidarity. So we want to delve further into ways that we can all support the Cuban people right now as they're entering some of the worst times that we've ever seen in the history of the Cuban Revolution. So we'll talk about ways and other solidarity groups that people can get involved with, and we'll share that more at May Day Books on Sunday at 2 p.m.
Yeah, so why did we go to Cuba? Well, we went to Cuba because we wanted to see what a socialist revolution was like. I myself had been to Nicaragua during the Contra War, another U.S. war of imperialism, which we want to point out. The more wars that a government instigates means that it's a failing empire. It takes away resources, but also it regenerates or puts people's minds in a different direction. So they're not thinking about their problems. They're thinking about U.S. victories or, they have their minds someplace else. But what Cuba has accomplished in their revolution is healthcare indicators that are higher than the United States, equal, even though they're an underdeveloped country because of the blockade, they're able to get their life expectancy to that or more of the United States or a developed country. Their infant mortality and rate was lower than the United States. their education. The only country that had 100% literacy was Norway. Cuba was the second and most educated population in the world with 99.9% literacy. Housing, one of their goals is to have housing for everybody. And they've also created a 100-year plan for environmental protection in light of climate change going on. Their biopharmaceutical industry has created vaccines and treatments for COVID, lung cancer, diabetic amputation prevention, and the latest that has gotten a lot of attention in the medical community is their Alzheimer's treatment to stop and reverse Alzheimer's. So this does not at all show a country that is a collapsed society or under incompetent communists. This is a society that is working for its people, and we'll talk more about how that happens. But when I was there, the one shipment of oil that got through at the end of March was being processed and by the Cuban refineries. And in the time I was there, from the middle of April to the beginning of May, they had taken it and gotten their economy starting to running again. And no collapsed society could do that in such a quick time. When I was in Havana, I experienced very, very infrequent, I'd have to say, almost 95% or more of the time where I was staying in the neighborhood of Havana, there was electricity. So again, what's happening in Cuba as a result of the blockade? And we'll talk more about that.
Thanks, Greg. I'm Rebecca, and the reason I went to Cuba, I'd been to Cuba in 1997, which was shortly after what was referred to as the special period, starting in 1991. And, you know, according to the Cubans and many people around the world, that in and of itself was a difficult time for Cuba after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But traveling to Cuba over May Day this year was very eye-opening, because the results and the devastating effects of the oil blockade were very real. Normally, there were many more ability to have many more transportation cars out on the street, people out and about in cafes and restaurants, and that was really lacking. But we traveled to Cuba for May Day specifically to show support with the Cubans on the International Workers' Day. And I think it was really important for our delegation, which is Building Relations with Cuban Labor, to meet with the CTC, which was the Centro Trabajadores de Cuba, which is the labor union structure in Cuba. And we were able to see how Cuba passes a new labor code and new family code by really integrating the opinions and the perspectives of people throughout their entire society, whether that be from the CDRs, the neighborhood organizations, all the way up to the national government. And it was really great to understand how Cuba's family code, one of the most progressive in the world, enshrines LGBTQ rights for all families, rights for single parents, for grandparents, and how that was achieved in 2019 through working class struggle.
And this is Jackie again. So the talking about the reason I traveled this time, I want to say in reference, this is my 7th trip to Cuba. My first trip was the early 2000s, and as a physical therapist who's always believed in healthcare being a human right and believing that the United States needs to pass universal healthcare. I went to Cuba for the very first time to study and learn about their healthcare system because I had seen amazing information. And I think as we talk again and encourage listeners to maybe consider a trip to Cuba, the thing is you don't understand what it's actually like and what is really going on there unless you travel there and see for yourself that what we hear in the U.S. media is definitely propaganda. I mean, these are people that are some of the best, most genuine, most community-centered people in the world. And we can see that in their work with medical missions and international support. But what I can say is the last time I went was 2014, so still within the Obama administration. And we could see the sort of the flourishing as Cuba was seeming to open up and starting to thrive. Now, comparing that with this trip, where it's same amazing people, but just really devastating to see the impact of these ongoing assaults being perpetuated by the U.S. government.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we constantly are bombarded with is misinformation in the media, especially the mainstream media. And I want to point out that National Public Radio is probably one of the most misleading information sources because it says they're independent, it says they're for the public, but they constantly are interviewing people who are, some of them have a former record of being CIA paid agent. Mostly people that are being working for corporate media, which will not allow voices of a narrative that doesn't go along with their stories. Just recently, the media talks about organization or actually an institution within the U.S. government, GESA, as being a secret institution within the government that is hoarding all the money that Cuba resources are being made. But that's the furthest from the truth. This is an institution that was created during that special period that was spoken about before when Cuba had a crisis, when the socialist bloc fell apart and the Berlin Wall fell down. They no longer had other countries that they could trade with and they were on their own. Well, being under the watchful eye of the main hacker of Cuba's information and resources, the United States, they need to set up a firewall in order to keep the United States from hacking into their information and their resources. And that's when they created GESA. And so this is like a firewall to create hackers from penetrating your financial bank accounts and stealing your money. So the way that it's being portrayed by the U.S. media, by the U.S. government, is again misleading you and wanting you to neutralize your efforts to oppose this policy. It wants to keep you looking in another direction. So that's something, and I want to point out that Metro Surge, the response from Minneapolis, Minnesota residents to the ICE invasion of Minnesota is the same kind of response that we need to this surge of violence against Cuba. Cuba is our neighbor. We were protecting our neighbors. They were integral to our communities, to our economy. Cuba is integral to our community, to our economy as a neighbor. We could be flourishing because of trade between the countries, because of normalization. Cuba is a beautiful place to visit. And so that is something that Minnesota needs, Minnesotans need to continue to implement that emergency response network in response to these imperialist wars. And we need to be the example, not only to the United States, but to the world, because the world is watching Minnesota right now.
Hey, Greg, I had a question about the program to prevent hacking of accounts as it relates to Cuba, and specifically, what's the status of remittances, and does that have to do with remittances from the U.S. to Cuba as well?
Yeah, in the area of remittances, when there were normal relations after the Obama normalization period, Western Union was able to channel remittances to the Cuban people from other countries, just like it works between the U.S. and any other country. All countries take a tax of those remittances, somewhere between 8 to 10%. And so those remittances, because so many Cubans, we hear again, especially on this report from Democracy Now, the commentator left out a lot of information, and that's purposely. Cubans not only are leaving Cuba, not really because they don't see a future. It's because their country is in such a bad situation and their families and friends are suffering that they're going to another country in order to make money to send it back to their families. Well, that was a problem for the U.S. government, and so they shut down any remittances. And the only remittances now that can occur is through these so-called remittance companies operating out of Miami that send money down to Cuba through mules. They actually take the money, take it to Cuba, but their cut is 40%. And you see that all these policies that are hurting Cuba are actually benefiting Miami. That's why Miami, why Southern Florida, why these Americans from the Cuban diaspora keep, why some of them, especially the elders or those who are making money off of it, want to keep it going, because it's an extravagant business for them. And they use that money to buy politicians in Congress. And that's why we can't seem to make headway, is that CANF, the Cuban American National Foundation, which is the lobbying arm of Miami and Southern Florida, actually works hand in hand with AIPAC, the Jewish lobbying arm that supports the genocide in Gaza and the wars in the Mideast.
And I just wanted to kind of piggyback off of what Greg was saying regarding the similarities between Minneapolis and Minnesota and Cuba, particularly since we're on Northern Sun Radio and our listeners are right here in Minneapolis and St. Paul. One of the things we're seeing with the myths and the false narratives in the media is the same thing that we saw with Operation Metro Surge and ICE occupation here in Minnesota, which includes, you know, the Trump administration's attempt to shut down the economy, blockading of funds. So whether that be through, you know, the over six decade long embargo, whether that be through Cuba's placement on the SSOT, the state sponsor of terrorism list, whether that be through additional sanctions placed, you know, at the end of January of this year, the oil blockade, or May 1st, like a secondary sanctions program. Very similar to how the Trump administration attempted to blockade funds of SNAP and Medicaid and child care services here in Minnesota during Operation Metro Surge. And it also includes the demonization of leaders. So obviously we saw that in Minnesota through our ICE occupation, whether that be the demonization of, our elected officials, our governor, our attorney general, is very similar to the demonization that we're seeing now of Raul Castro, and who is a hero of the Cuban Revolution and has been indicted on false murder charges from 1996. And it also includes, very attempts at imposing actual physical violence, whether that be, in Minnesota, we saw that through ICE agents violently coming down very hard on protesters and neighbors, or violently abducting our neighbors. And in Cuba, we're seeing that right now with the placement of U.S. Aircraft carriers right off of their coast, and with direct threats of military attacks against the people of Cuba. So I think it's important to note those similarities, because we here in Minnesota have experienced that on a smaller scale, but firsthand.
Well, one of the things I've always thought about with Cuba, which was part of the reason why the Trump administration came down so hard here in Minnesota, is a good example. What we did, what had happened here in Minnesota, people were being taken care of. There was a high level of people working. It was a good economy. People were integrated. And Cuba, of course, has been a national example. Well, everybody in Latin America could say, "Well, yeah, look at what they're doing there. Look what they're doing there. We can't let that be an example." And so they continually pile on there. I mean, like it's makes it like difficult. One thing I wanted to bring up about the trade. Now, they've had this embargo. Somebody can talk about why it's illegal, but it's been 60 years or so. But why can't Cuba trade? Well, the U.S. has ways of doing it. Does somebody want to talk to that?
Yeah. So, initially, when the embargo started, it was banning trade between the United States and Cuba, because Cuba had been a neo-colony of the United States and depended almost exclusively on trade between the United States and Cuba, especially in the area of sugar. That was the major, because Cuba had such good land, the United States used it to raise sugar cane to make sugar for all the products that our sweet tooths needed. But as Cuba began to diversify, and because of that embargo hurt U.S. businesses, they began to trade with other nations. And so specifically, the United States, who after World War II had created an international financial system that made the world dependent on trade with a U.S. dollar. And in that area, the United States has been able to make sure now, through different executive orders and acts like the Helms-Burton Act, to make trade with any company internationally sanctioned, in that if you trade with Cuba, you aren't going to be able to open up a bank account or do any trade with the United States. Well, we're the biggest market in the world, or one of the biggest markets in the world. And so no company is going to be making that choice over a small country like Cuba financially. And so that was one of the intents of this latest May 1st executive order by Trump and Rubio, was to make sure that any company that is trading with Cuba in the area of tourism, in the area of mining. So this cut out Canadian companies, this cut out Spanish companies, French companies, Italian companies, that not only could they not operate their hotels in the United States or do any kind of mining licenses in the United States, but they also could have their assets taken. And the United States wouldn't even have to tell them. So why does the United Nations every year, year after year, almost all the countries in the world, including our allies, vote against this blockade? Because it infringes on their own economy. And so, but again, the United States continues to be the bully and is going to bully everybody around. Well, this is going to have detrimental effects on our own economy. And pretty soon the world is going to say, we don't want that U.S. dollar financial system. We're going to create something else. And that's when the bottom's going to come out for the United States economy. And it's going to hurt the majority of the people here. It's not going to affect the people at the top of the pecking order.
And it is. And thanks, Greg, for bringing that point up, because it's also already hurt the economy in Minnesota. There have been multiple, during normalization or a period of normalization under the Obama administration, there was quite a bit more trade with Minnesota and in Cuba with agriculture. And since Trump's recent tariffs, a lot of Minnesota farmers have really wanted to trade with Cuba because it would benefit our state economy and it would benefit the people of Cuba. And we're not allowed to do that. So it actually has direct effects on us here, as well as the fact that a lot of the biotech developments that Cuba has made over the course of the last several years that Greg mentioned, the Alzheimer's medication, the two different vaccinations for lung cancer, diabetes treatment, all of that the Cubans are unable to patent in the United States. And if they can't have it patented here, it's very difficult to have it patented around the world. And then it's very difficult for them to trade or for other countries, including us here in Minnesota, to be able to access that medication. We have a lot of members of our organizations that would benefit from Alzheimer's medication, from the technological advances in diabetes medication and lung cancer medication that Cuba has developed, but we're unable to access those things.
Lots of great examples, and I want to point out that most of these cross-party lines, too, it's not simply some bicameral or dichotomy. And I want to mention also, with regard to the United Nations, this is why these cruel sanctions are completely illegal, because the only legal such sanctions have to be approved by the General Assembly, and they never will be year after year after year. As Greg said, there's about 5 votes supporting the sanctions and 190 nations opposing them.
Mm-hmm. And the two key countries that vote against it are the U.S. and Israel.
Of course,
so I think,
yeah.
But what I think is interesting, and what's going on right now with the audacity of this administration, is that people are starting to see more connections between the U.S. and Israel on these things. You know, we're seeing, you know, in this war against Iran, Lebanon, like, we're seeing these similar things across the world, and I think Americans are starting to maybe get that a bit more, which is good to know. But I also want to just stress to people, like, imagine, so one thing I can say for sure, the Cuban people love American people. They don't love our government, but they love us, and they love our culture, and they just want the chance to to flourish, which if we, you know, with the 67-year embargo, if we would get out of their way, they would, you know, become such a prosperous nation. The ingenuity and the innovation and the resilience of what they've been able to accomplish during these 67 years, and even with the current oil embargo, blockade, which is just devastating this country. I mean, I want everyone listening to imagine that right now, there's all the gas stations are closed. That's what we saw. Black market fuel of what can be sold is being sold for $14 a liter. So, you know, I don't know, that'd be like
$40 a gallon.
$40 a gallon, there you go. So that's what you'd have to pay. So, and then there's no electricity. They're going for days without electricity. And also the electricity helps to drive the water pumps. So we're literally strangling them right now. And now, again, additional ongoing economic sanctions, like just now that Visa and MasterCard are going to stop supporting payments coming from all over the globe. So again, this is a crisis moment, and we're here to tell the story of what we just witnessed and encourage the listeners to do some more research. Come hear what we have to say on Sunday, this Sunday at 2 p.m. at May Day Books. Find out ways to donate. We'll share that information about ways that you can get involved. And then just be ready. Like, we want to be ready in case we need to do a rapid response if there's an escalation in potential military action against Cuba.
I'd like to hear just a little more from you folks about the one of the main outrageous lies, which is that it's a terrorist and supports terrorism, when in fact, as insiders have said, but dating back several administrations, Cuba cooperated a great deal with drug interdiction as well as terrorism interdiction. So can you tell us more about the state of that?
Mm-hmm. Well, Cuba's main export is their medical brigades. And so, you know, in the U.S., under the U.S. empire, we export war, we export bombs, we export genocide. And Cuba exports, you know, healthcare and doctors to countries around the world, including our own. My own doctor, for instance, was trained at ELAM, the Latin American School of Medicine. She practices in northeast Minneapolis at a clinic that accepts, you know, people just like myself, single moms on Medicaid, children who don't necessarily have health insurance. This is the type of false narrative that we receive all the time in the U.S. media, which is propaganda. Cuba is a peace-loving nation. It always has been. And they are the victim of U.S. terrorism and not the source of it.
But excuse me, but if you want people to contact a congressman, I want to get a little information here specifically about this terrorism designation so that they can counteract that in their communications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, state sponsors of terrorism. So here's the excuses that they use. One, Cuba protected black liberation activists from prosecution in the United States. Probably the most popular case was Assata Shakur. Who had been attacked by police, and in that attack, a police officer was killed, and she was charged with the murder, even though all evidence shows she was shot in the back and was in no way in a gunfight. But Cuba gave that protection. They've also been involved with liberation, supporting liberation across the globe from Colombia. They were instrumental in supporting a peace agreement between the Colombian government and the local insurgents there, the People's Army, known as FARC. Cuba was not a supporter of terrorism. They brought together parties to make peace. And probably the most famous instance was Cuba's intervention in the invasion of Angola by South Africa and their defeat of South Africa, which led to the liberation of South Africa from apartheid. And when Nelson Mandela became president, and it resulted in the release of Nelson Mandela from jail, when Nelson Mandela became president, the first trip he made was to Cuba to thank them and to thank Fidel for that intervention. But on and on we can go about Palestine and the support of the creation of a Palestinian state to get the rights of Palestinians returned to them after the invasion in 1948 of their lands by Zionists. We've also got, so those are things, you know, it's kind of like, who's the terrorist? Well, isn't the terrorist all the organizations in southern Florida that have been attacking Cuba throughout the years? In fact, that's what Raul, his charge was, even though it's said to be based on downing unarmed pilots, he was actually defending Cuba because those pilots were actually, after the socialist bloc fell and Cuba was in that vulnerable period of the special period, those pilots were actually flying over Cuban airspace in order to judge the defenses of Cuba at this specially weak time. And because they were headed by people that had tried to invade Cuba in the Bay of Pigs, that had attacked Cuba through various terrorist acts, Cuba had to say, look, we can't allow this kind of terrorist planning, and if you do it again, and this was like their 17th time that they were invading Cuban airspace, they even told the American government, and the American government, who knew about the terrorism on Cuba but was letting it happen, they knew that Cuba was going to shoot down those airplanes, and they let those airplanes go even though. And in fact, the leader, he turned around so that he wouldn't be shot down because they knew that the Cubans were going to shoot down, create an incident just like they're doing now that resulted in that Helms-Burton Act that I had talked about before. It got the dander up of Congress, and through that lobbying power and through your, you know, Cuba's a terrorist nation, Cuba's communist, blah, 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 blah. They were able to fearmonger Congress into voting for more bad legislation, just like all the other legislation that affects us. But I think, you know, one thing that Don brought up, probably the biggest threat of Cuba to the United States is that they can be a successful model to what's happening in the United States, to our perverse healthcare industry that's commandeered by a health insurance industry that's defunding education, making it so that only the rich can have education by creating a chaotic housing plan where people end up in the streets, not in homes. Cuba was trying to reverse all that through just planned economy, planning. And that's something that's a threat to the United States. And that's why Cuba can't survive, because then we would get some great examples and we might try implementing that and taking back power to the people not letting it to be run by corporate lobbyists. And that's something Minnesota needs to do. Again, I want to call out the bravery of the rapid response to Metro Surge. You put your lives on the line. Our emergency response, rapid response network, is only asking that you show up in the streets. Of course, we may need your courage down the line as our numbers grow, and they want to send in some more ICE agents. But that's where we are, and that's what we have to rise to. So again, you know, I want to say that in response to gathering information, I want to, if you go to YouTube, there's a number of organizations. One is Breakthrough News. They're reporting directly from Cuba. They have balanced reporting. Well, they'll report on what Rubio and Trump is saying, but then they'll have reports on what Cubans are saying. Also, you got Belly of the Beast. That's another great information resource that's reporting directly from inside Cuba. Mint Press is run out of Minneapolis. Their website is another great source of getting inside information. I think Jacobin magazine is a credible resource information. And our organizations are affiliated with a national organization called National Network on Cuba, or the acronym is NNOC.org, has tons of information, events going on, legislative lobbying. We are affiliated with organizations such as Democratic Socialists of America and other organizations across the United States. And so those are places that you can tune in on and get some good information. Balanced reporting, I should say.
I found a Belly of the Beast e-newsletter quite informative. It gives you good links to other videos and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's excellent. I would definitely go to that right now. Belly of the Beast, get on that e-newsletter. That's one of the best balanced reporting that you can find.
Some of the commentators have been saying, well, we've got all these ships that we put in the area of Cuba. Why can't we just do what we did in Venezuela? Have a quick and easy, just fly in, scoop up a few leaders, and everything will be hunky-dory.
Well, and I think that goes back to, I mean, reminding us of our own history, okay? We had our American Revolution, right? We had our own revolution, and declaring our independence in 1776, you know, the Boston Tea Party. So historically, though, when the propaganda we're fed is because the U.S. is notorious about overthrowing democratically elected individuals across the globe. And usually who we're overthrowing are people that are elected in socialist or communist countries. So we say that we're there to protect democracy, but we're there to mostly protect capitalism for U.S. corporations and oligarchs. And that's the concern. There, right now, if that happens, this is what, like, this small cohort of very vocal, very financially backed people in South Florida have been doing for decades. They want Cuba back for themselves, not for the Cuban people, but for the corporations to go back and reclaim all this land and start taking over. So I think it's just important that as we are seeing in our own country, the sort of escalation and, you know, the growth of the power of all these corporations, these billionaires, that it's a slippery slope. And I don't think we like the direction we're seeing here. And we're also seeing like some of the pretty devastating impacts, especially when we look at Iran. So yes, they intervened in Venezuela, which actually is directly affecting Cuba now, because Venezuela was one of the few countries that was consistently trying to help Cuba in these rough times.
Part of why they were attacked, a big part of why Venezuela was attacked, was their support for Cuba.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And now the oil's being diverted and controlled by the U.S., and our refineries were specifically in the Gulf set up for Venezuelan oil, and so this is another imperial grab.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, one of the reasons that Cuba has been so resilient and unified in the face of decades of the most severe blockade in modern history, if not history itself, is that they've had, like us, decades of fighting for independence. They fought against the Spanish from 1868 until 1898. Then, once the United States intervened in that what we call the Spanish-American War, which is really the War of Independence for Cuba, we intervene at the very last moment to take control of Cuba. The Monroe Doctrine always said that America for the Americans, which meant that the Western Hemisphere was the playground of American capitalism. And Cuba was under the direct tutelage of U.S. corporations. They stole the land and created the sugar industries. The mafia came in, created tourism, and benefited from that, while the majority of people were left destitute. And when they had enough of that, that's when the rebellion began, and Fidel became a leader and overthrew that regime, and they're still fighting. So that has made them unified and resilient. And one of the things that you can count on with Cubans is that they're able to invent ways of getting around these obstacles. And when we were in Cuba, we saw that Cuba was quickly building their manufacturing electric motorcycles. We saw those in the streets all the time. They're manufacturing electric tricycles. They're like ATVs, but they have a bed in the back that can carry 6 to 8 people, and those replace buses in transporting people and getting supplies around the country. And still today, in this blackout, this oil blockade, they're still able to get food from the countryside into the cities to feed people. They're still able to keep those markets open. And so, yeah, that's why right now Rubio and Trump are pulling their hair out. They do not understand why Cuba does not fall apart. But they have a spirit, and they're going to stick together. And if you see balanced reporting, you're going to see tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Cubans in the street ready to defend their country. They come out for demonstrations of all kinds to show their support and to show that it's not going to be an easy operation. And, you know, even if they took out some of the leaders or bombed a decision-making building, they are not going to affect Cuban society, because what we saw was a Cuban society that democratically created their constitution and created the laws that Rebecca was talking about it, and she'll talk more about democracy in Cuba.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. What Greg was saying in terms of resiliency and Cubans just coming out to the streets time and time again is what we saw when we were there recently for May Day. You know, 500,000 Cubans showing up on the Malecón and in the Revolutionary Plaza to protest and to stand up against Trump and Rubio's policies. And, you know, there were 5 million Cubans, I believe, across the country as well, and throughout the provinces that did that on May Day as well. And one of the things I think that we see that's so impressive with Cuba is that even in these really, really challenging times that are inflicted by U.S. imperialist policy against Cuba, is that the Cubans are maintaining their sense of public education and public support, whether that be through schools, you know, through their healthcare. They are being incredibly inventive with how they are still attempting to produce food for the people and in workers in Cuba. So I don't think it's going to be the same situation that we saw in Venezuela. And one other thing I'd like to mention that Dave asked in terms of contacting our elected officials. It is very important to contact our senators and representatives to ask them to support War Powers Resolution. It is also important to ask them to support and co-author both the Wyden and McGovern bills in the House and the Senate, which is legislation proposed that to end the embargo, the over 6-decade-long embargo against Cuba.
So I had Ann Wright on here 2 months ago. She was she was just back from trying to get into Gaza with a flotilla, and had been to Cuba. And there's a way to get into Cuba, and it's not illegal, is it?
No, it's not.
We traveled there legally on a license from the U.S. government in support of the Cuban people.
So you can't do that if you can work it out and if you find out how it can happen.
And you can go through a variety. There are all kinds of brigades, Venceremos Brigade, Mayday Brigade, Building Relations with Cuban Labor. There are all kinds of trips that groups host. And when you travel there, you're doing it very legally, and you have all kinds of support from the Cuban people, and it's a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm. With regard to the Congress people, I want to mention two things. Of course, what we're trying to end is an embargo that is cruel and illegal and unnecessary, but also the positive features that were mentioned here today about our medical and agricultural and all the great trade ties that we could have.
Yeah, I mean, that's just it. We could. There's so much that they're all about building relations. That's what the Cuban people want. They want to build these relations. The Cuban people want to be successful. They want to share, and they want us to come visit as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been good to have an hour on this. I want to thank Greg Clavey and Rebecca Pera. She's with the WAM group called SOTA.
SCOTA, yeah. Solidarity Committee on the Americas.
And Greg is with the Minnesota Cuba Committee, and Jackie here is an activist here on the station.
Yes.
Very good.
And board member.
And board
Go
member.
Go KFAI.
Right on.
So Sunday, 2 p.m., May Day Books. We're taking donations for that prenatal, maternal mortality prevention program that we're promoting.
Got it.
So we're not, we, We're not wanting
Welcome to
paint
MN90.
Minnesota.
Yeah.
Now. Support for KFAI comes in part from First Avenue, presenting the Red and Horton Heat at the Turf Club Saturday, June 20th. Dallas Psychobilly Trio, the Red and Horton Heat, are back with their latest release, Roots of the Rev, Volume 1. It's an all-covers album
John,
paying tribute to the roots of rockabilly and country in an old-school, stripped-out, lo-fi way that only the Red and Horton Heat can convey.
So,
opening the show are the Surf for Jets.
Yeah.
More information about the Red and Horton Heat at the Turf Club is available at first-avenue.com.